those. Without further ado, let's start. I'm going to hand over to the Minister for the introduction of the forensic procedure, criminal law forensic procedure amendment bill. Minister.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to members of the committee. I see in the committee here there is someone who looks like a member I saw in the newspaper, very angry, you know, fighting last week. But I thought it's a twin brother. I'm not sure. Well, thanks, Chair. Thank you. Chair, the process has been long. If we take a step back, we'd remember that the criminal justice system review process, which started some years ago, put up this very important part of the fight against crime, the forensic science, to solve particularly violent crimes, and introducing the scientific approach to solving of crimes in the country, and we are now, you know, walking that path which has been alluded to some time ago. The essence of the bill is the establishment of the DNA database within SAPS for analysis, and such analysis kept particularly for detection and investigation of crime and criminality generally. It's a technical bill, but what has helped the process, Chair, is that the committee has been intimately involved in the process, as started with the introduction of the bill itself. The first part of it, which dealt with the fingerprints in 2009, and finally adopted in 2010. This has also been assisted by the study tours, which the committee has embarked upon, just to check and compare with others in the world. I can recall the study tour to Canada and UK, which in the main took on board a number of things. Amongst them was the issue of human rights, which has been raised, particularly in our situation here at home. There are limitations then imposed on the use of and access to DNA database. The abuse of which would be unlawful and resulting in serious criminal offense, particularly in this regard. It also provides for the protection to children, as was the case with the fingerprint one. There are legislation that are affected there in this bill, since it cuts across different departments and legislation. The Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, for instance, is one such department which is affected by the bill because of the Criminal Procedure Act, Act 51 of 1977. The SAPS Act itself, SAPS Act of SAPS Act number 68 of 1995, the Firearms Control Act of 2000, and so on. So these are some of the departments and legislation which have been affected. Now, the Department of Correctional Services is proposed to be involved in the taking of Bakel of a person convicted, particularly on Schedule 1. These are some of the things. There are other internal mechanisms which are aimed at ensuring checks and balances and oversight of the entire process so that there is no abuse, but also processes of expungement and so on. I would give to the team to, through you, Chair, to get particularly to the technical aspect of it. But for us, we are satisfied that whilst the process has been a bit lengthy, but it was an important process to embark upon so that we are certain that at the end of the day, we come up with this very important tool of fighting crime in our country. What would be important for also, Chairperson, would be the plan to implement the bill itself, and the personnel who would be the foot soldiers implementing of the bill at the technical level. As you know, that we concluded the filling of 800 posts in this area, particularly crime scene management people, and people would be particularly the analysts, forensic analysts. We've concluded that we are going to be taking the second round on such people from the point of view of preparing ourselves and ensuring that indeed we have the bill, we see its effectiveness, its implementation, and I think from that point of view we are satisfied where we are seated, that all has been done. Would have wanted to have this process much earlier, but it delayed for a purpose. And I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. Over to the technical team, who's going to lead the process.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Minister. Just to the team consists of the forensic laboratories headed by General Patlani, the staff from my office, Wilkie Omar, who was responsible for the policy development and engaging around the bill, and Ms. Dawn Bell from our legislation unit, and General Jacobs, and obviously Brigadier Shezi is accompanying. General Shezi is accompanying the forensic laboratories, and it has been a joint drafting process between them. Just before I ask General Jacobs to just take us through the bill, I think there are three important issues that we needed to address in the bill coming back. The first was looking at the issue of our capacity to implement the bill. And I think the Minister's referred to the fact that there is an implementation plan that accompanies this bill. The second was the issues of looking at the rights and issues of looking at how we protect processes around this bill. And I think General Jacobs will take you through how that is dealt with. And the third issue is the consultation. We have had quite extensive intergovernmental consultations, as the Minister referred to, in particular with the Department of Health and Corrections, who are affected by this bill. So I'll just ask General Jacobs to take us through the bill.
Commissioner Jacobs, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I'll just, excuse me just a second. Chair, the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill was introduced in Parliament following the recommendations of the Office for the Criminal Justice Reform. The bill dealt with issues related to enhancing the use of fingerprints and especially interdepartmental cooperation to link different fingerprint databases for criminal investigation purposes. The bill furthermore provided for the establishment of a DNA database to enhance criminal investigations. The bill was considered by the Portfolio Committee on Police, which decided to only deal with the fingerprint part of the bill and to conduct comparative research into the DNA issues before dealing with the aspects dealing with DNA. The DNA part of the bill was referred back to the Minister of Police so that it could be aligned with the research to be undertaken by the Portfolio Committee and any findings and recommendations. The Portfolio Committee on Police undertook a study tour abroad that the Minister referred to, accompanied by officials of the SAPS and members of the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. A policy document was prepared and presented to Parliament in 2012 and has been aligned with common practices overseas. The bill was then drafted and taken through the Development Committee. The bill was approved and presented to Cabinet for approval for introduction to Parliament. The Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development has agreed that the Minister of Police can introduce the bill. Chair, I think the committee will recall that the first bill was introduced first to the Justice Department and then referred to this committee. The drafting of the bill was done by the South African Police Service Forensic Services, the SAPS Legal Services, as well as the Civilian Secretariat of Police, working jointly as a single committee. And the following departments were consulted on the drafting of the bill, namely the Department of Health, Department of Correctional Services, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the National Prosecuting Authority, and the JCPS Directors General Cluster, and the Development Committee, as well as a civil society. The bill establishes a DNA database within the SAPS and recognizes the role a DNA database can play in fighting crime. DNA samples will be analyzed and profiles stored for the purposes of detection of crime and the investigation of cases. The bill also pays attention to the necessary limitations and protections required in terms of human rights issues. The DNA database will consist of five indices. Firstly, the crime scene index of samples taken at a crime scene. Secondly, the arrestees index. Thirdly, the volunteers index, which is used basically for exclusion purposes. Then the convicted offender index. And lastly, the elimination index. The bill allows for DNA buckle samples to be taken by police officials trained in the taking of samples in line with the prescripts of the Minister of Health. Provides for non-intimate samples, or non-intimate samples include buckle samples taken from under a nail of a person or from the nail of a person, and the buckle sample itself is taken from the inside of the mouth and may only be taken by police officials with the prescribed training. Intimate samples, excluding buckle samples, may only be taken by a registered medical doctor or a registered nurse. The bill provides for the expungement of records in the case where the prosecution decides not to prosecute or where a person had been found not guilty of an offence. Chair, and this is in line with the fingerprint legislation that we have dealt with already. The bill provides for the reporting to Parliament in respect of the DNA database. The bill also places responsibilities on the National Commissioner to ensure that generally accepted information, security practices and procedures are followed. The bill introduces a National Forensic Oversight Board comprising of both governmental and non-governmental role players. The board is also tasked with advising the Minister on reviewing legislation, regulations, policy and protocols related to the use of DNA. Chairperson, and if we look at the experience we had previously, there's a well-developed implementation plan for the bill, which has been costed and presented to the JCPS Development Committee, the Departments of Correctional Services and Health were specifically consulted on the plan, because they will be intimately involved with the implementation process. Chair, that is basically the contents of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Members, questions of clarity. We're going to obviously get intimately involved with the bill at a later stage, but questions of clarity at this point? Honourable Glover.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the Minister, and thank you to the presenter, John Jacobs. When it comes to the context of the bill, you talk about five areas. You talk about crime scene index, arresting index, volunteer index, convicted index, offender index and elimination index. Can you elaborate on that so that you will understand exactly what we are talking about? And the second question, Chairperson, is the prescribed officials, those who have been trained. Do you have the human resource, as the minister said, that they have already employed? Have you had the people trained? Because the 9 intermediate samples were included by baccalaureate samples that taken by the official prescribed trained people. Those are the two questions, madam. Thanks.
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, just one question is this question of consultation. See, previously there was a big problem with consultation. I hear now you've consulted almost, talking about all government departments. I just wanted to be clear. Did you consult outside governments and other structures that have got interest on this matter?
I've also got a question that I would like to ask. Commissioner Jacobs, can I ask you just to switch off your microphone, please? My apologies. I want to refer to the board. Specifically in the UK, we've seen an ethics committee type of structure. And I want to get clarity whether this board would play that dual role of also being an ethics committee dealing with the ethics around DNA, etc., so that we can, I think it's very important for us, and it's something that the committee needs to apply its mind to, in terms of a constitutional-based democracy with a Bill of Human Rights, to make sure that we are dealing with those types of issues properly. So I just want to get clarity on the board itself. Over to yourself if there's no more questions.
Chair, I will ask General Chersey to deal with Honourable Member Mclaubel's questions relating to training and indexes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Perhaps I may request General Jacobs to just go back to the slides that show the indices and I can talk to them individually. Thank you, Chairperson, Honourable Members. The first one talks to the crime scene index, samples taken of the crime scene. There are 5 classifications of the DNA database. The crime scene index will be talking to those samples that are gathered from the crime scene itself. It means at any stage when the investigating officer has collected samples, be it housebreaking cases, be it rape cases, be it cash in heist cases, any sample that has been collected from the scene of crime itself will be categorized under those indices. When you see in the contents of the bill, you will realize that it is within these indices that the samples are retained indefinitely because they are not, by virtue of their existence, associated to a specific individual, but they can be linked to a particular crime or a specific crime. So that is the first index. The other one calls to the arrestees index. In the bill, it is contained that the people will be arrested, and it defines that it is their schedules, the schedule offenses, and there's a provision in terms of when the samples could be collected, as well as it goes on to describe other cases or other scenarios outside the schedule 1 offenses in which a person is arrested. When a person is arrested, based on those provisions, a sample will be taken, and then it will be characterized under that index, the arrestee index. It is at this index where the case has not been finalized in court yet. It is still in process. It is still under investigation. It is still an arrestee. There has not been any judgment made as yet, so it is an arrestee index. The next category talks to General Jacobs. The volunteer index. The volunteer index will be then those samples where there is a scenario that is made in the bill itself where it refers to in instances where a group of personnel can be, to where there is a reasonable ground for a police officer to suspect a crime, then samples could be requested to people on the basis of exclusion. It is in this index where people are requested to give consent. The bill prescribes in detail that a consent must be obtained from a person to volunteer a sample. In those instances where a person does not want to volunteer a sample, different processes will go on. But volunteer really means a volunteer in those in that context. A person can volunteer in samples, maybe not on the arrestee basis, just also on capacitating that by the bill itself or the database. But this is a volunteer index. The next one talks to the convicted offender index. This is the index where people have already been convicted. Cases have proceeded in court. It may be cases, people that are offended even before the coming into effect of the bill or legislation, but people have already been convicted. Or it could be the current ones, but as long as the word convicted has been obtained, the case has been through court, judgment has been pronounced. It doesn't matter what the classification of judgment is, serious offense, non-serious offense. As long as there's a conviction, there's a convicted index where the samples will then be retained and kept in that particular index. The last index talks to the elimination index. This particularly refers mainly to people who are working with samples, the crime scene managers themselves, to eliminate the contamination possibilities, talks to people who are working within the laboratories. It also talks to manufacturers of products that we utilize for the DNA. It happened in many instances in the UK, in the US, that at some point in time the DNA profile of the people working within the company that produced the product to be used for the utilization of the DNA were found during that process. So in those instances, we require our suppliers to also volunteer a personnel elimination index, for example, to be contained in that particular index. You will realize that the volunteer index and the elimination index are two categories that are not necessarily crime-based or crime-focused, particularly the elimination database, but it is for reference mainly to exclude our own in cases of contamination. Thank you, madam.
Chair, I think also under the volunteer index we'd be looking at missing children, et cetera, that may be listed under that volunteer index where a parent gives voluntary consent. Just in terms of the consultation processes,
before you get to the consultation process, the training issue is still outstanding.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe on the training, there was also an issue related to capacity, which the Minister alluded to. Just to place on record, we started in 2010-2011. We first employed 700 people in the 2010-2011 financial year. In 2011-12, we employed 750. 2012-2013, which is the year that just concluded, 800. In this financial year, we are employing additional 710 people. And as the Minister indicated, in the main, we are capacitating crime scene management. So these people, the graduates that we are employing, we are deploying them to ensure crime scene management, but also increasing our capacity within the forensic science laboratories as far as forensic analysts are concerned. But one key area that we had to capacitate is quality management for the purpose of compliance, standardization, and so on. So part of these numbers went into that particular area. Now, there is a requirement to have the broader subs members trained. At this stage, the focus was on the people in forensic services to get them ready for the implementation at the point. There is an engagement as part of the consultation with the Department of Health, where the department, the National Health Laboratories, will then present the training to the broader subs personnel. That engagement is at an advanced stage, and as soon as we have done the finalization there of the training program will be rolled out. But while we are engaging in that regard, we also embarked on an awareness program to sensitize the people on what the implications hereof will be, so that we are not caught wanting at a point where the act is in place. Thanks, Chair.
Just to add what General Pakalani is saying, we are busy signing a memorandum of understanding with the health department around the training, where they're also looking at the universities, and it'll only be trained officials that will then be able to take the samples. They'll be trained and accredited before they're able to take the samples. In terms of the consultations inside and outside government, I think we've spoken about inside government. We did have quite extensive consultations outside government through the Policy and Research Reference Group and also with specific people with interests in DNA, like the DNA Project, and I think the people here from the DNA Project. We did engage with them throughout the process from outside of government, from looking specifically at the issue with the reference group of controls and measures that we have in place with regard to that. Definitely the board would need to look at ethics because it's an oversight body, so it would need to look at ethics as well as setting standards around it, and we'd need to make sure that in the bill it is given the necessary capacity to do that. Thanks, Chair.
Members, any further questions? I still have two, if I may. The one is, before I ask mine, Honourable Ndlovu, and then Honourable George, and then myself.
No, Chairperson, I think I'm covered, but I'm a little bit worried if the head of secretariat said that they still haven't signed the memo of understanding with the Department of Health. Because when the bill is passed tomorrow, I'm just making a clear example. When the bill is passed tomorrow, the figures that has been said by General Pahlane won't fit into the old stations that we are talking about. Therefore, if there is no memo of understanding at this moment in time, how long it will take to do that? Because that will be the hinges of everything that will take place. Because if people can't move around without the crime scene because there is nobody to take samples and so on and so forth, then you make people to lie there for more than 2 hours and so on and so forth, that is a discredit to the department and so on. I'm a little bit worried about that.
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, I don't know whether they're going to respond now, but probably sometime we need to discuss. You see, the secretary said the implementation plan is ready, which is very good, because that's where normally we fight with SAPS when we are busy with legislation. But what General Pahlane said makes me wonder whether the statement made by the General Secretary and what Mr. General Pahlane is saying, whether they correlate, but probably we'll it's not time for that. We might deal with that when we deal with the whole bill.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the crime scene index samples and the arrestee index samples, won't the same samples appear? Say, for instance, they were taken at the crime scene. Won't it be a duplication if now they come again at the arrestee index? Thanks, Chair.
I've got two questions that I just want to pose. So one is the issue of a warrant. Can you indicate to us whether you've considered the use of a warrant to get and obtain samples? I'm not worried about the volunteer. I think there are prime examples of the volunteer database in legislation already, in terms of the firearms legislation for one, and I believe also the constitutional protection of constitutional, the terrorist legislation. That also speaks to taking of samples of people on a scene, whether they were involved or not. But can you just indicate to us the role of warrants and whether you've considered that? And then I'm also, I think, members, we need to take next week
take a clause-by-clause evaluation from the researchers of Parliament, and secondly, the implementation plan. I think the implementation plan needs to be presented to members next week before we even start engaging with the legislation, so that we are satisfied that everything is in place. But also the issue of officers. I hear what this General Patlani has been explaining. We hear what you say in terms of the number of people, but I think members' questions are more towards the officers that will take the samples, the training of the officers that will take the samples. Who are we talking about? How will we determine who they are? How are they going to be selected? Have you thought about what type of police officer are we looking for in order to do this? I mean, in my mind, just thinking about, you're definitely not going to have a TRT guy taking samples of the public in terms of DNA, or even the public order policing unit taking samples. What type of police officer are we talking about? Are we talking about detectives, trained detectives? What are we talking about? Who are they? And I think that's where the question comes in. Your labs might be ready. Your crime scene might be ready. But the collection of samples on the ground, that's the question that members are concerned about. And can you give us an indication there what we are talking about? Honorable Legetu.
Thanks, Chair. Honorable Minister, thanks. General Patlani, thanks for your detailed information regarding appointments that we'll be making soon. I did not hear the date of those 710 appointments for crime scene management you talked about. Probably it will help me, my honorable George, to have those dates.
I ask members to speak for themselves and let other members speak for themselves, please. Continue, Honorable George. Honorable Legetu, continue.
What
can we get order, Honorable Legetu, continue?
Thanks, Chair. What will be requirement for these appointments, General Patlani? Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chair. Again, apologies for the hour-long traffic jam. I wonder if I could just have some clarity. Having read through the bill and perhaps going through it line by line with the researchers, that may assist, but perhaps we can get the clarity now. It was a fairly contentious issue, familial searching, but had tracked down numerous criminals in that if they found the one example we were given, blood on a brick, killed a police officer. And they put the blood through the system and they could not find a match. There was no criminal with that matched that. However, they did a familial search and found someone very similar, went to the house and indeed found it was the brother of this person. So is that allowed? It seems to be in the legislation. Is there a particular area we should be looking at? For that, is it going to cause any difficulties, certainly when we have our public hearings? Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I want to close questions now. No questions.
Just in response to Honourable Member Ntlobo's question, we're basically on the final stages of signing that memorandum of understanding. However, there is already agreement in place that the Health Department will do the training. So even if the memorandum takes another month or 2 months, the Health Department will continue with that training, but we just want to formalise it in terms of a memorandum. I'll ask General Shezi to answer the question from Honourable Member George around the index samples that he raised.
Okay. Was it Honourable Angie who asked about the crime scene? Yeah, yes, correct. She asked about the relation between the crime scene index sample as well as the RSD index sample. Perhaps in answering that question, I'll also talk a little bit about the training, just to give clarity. When we had consulted on this bill, we had ensured that amongst the people that wouldn't be preferred to be trained are the crime scene examiners themselves. Because while we are at a crime scene, the role of the crime scene examiner is to pick up evidence that is left at the crime scene. You wouldn't want to introduce an element which may be risen as doubt and allow a crime scene examiner to also collect a sample from an arrestee. Because an arrestee is an individual, it is not a crime scene. It is a person who is suspected of having committed an offense. So by virtue of that, it wouldn't be a crime body or a crime area or as such as the question arises. So the question is twofold, Honorable AG. It may be that when the sample is collected from that arrestee, it may not be in the particular crime scene, maybe elsewhere, outside that particular crime scene. There may be a match, which is some of the things that may be defined within the database itself. However, for the purposes as defined, the arrestee sample and the crime sample are two independent things which are completely unrelated to each other. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, I'll ask General Jacobs to just deal with the issue of warrants, because it is included in some circumstances and not others. That was asked by yourself.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we followed basically the same model as with the fingerprint legislation, whereas a buckle sample, but only a buckle sample, must be taken for when a person is being arrested in terms of a Schedule 1 offence. And, Chair, the issue was definitely discussed in very much detail. But you can imagine with the number of people that's being arrested for Schedule 1 offences, and if you oblige the police service to take in respect of all arrests for Schedule 1 offences, to obtain a warrant, it will actually become impossible. We've also checked that with our detective service and so on. So I think what we must realise that there's a very clear distinction between other bodily samples, like blood samples, which must be taken by a doctor or a registered nurse. So, Chair, we did definitely look at it, and you will also see that when we come to the amendments to the Firearms Control Act and the Explosives Act, that we have there a slight distinction where a person is not arrested, that you would require a warrant for arrest for the taking. So it was really taken into account, but I think we need to look at the practical implications of getting a warrant. And if you look at taking a buccal sample in terms of the effect it has on a person's rights, and you compare that with a fingerprint, there's really not that much of a difference. And that is why in the bill as well, that a buccal sample is being regarded as a non-intimate sample. Thank you, Chair.
Please.
Chair, I think the issue of the selection criteria for officers and who they're going to be and how they're going to be, I think when we present the implementation plan next week, we will go into detail looking at that issue, unless there's something that General Shazi wants to add.
Just give us an indication now.
Thank you, Chair. We have categorized our training for police officials into the different types of people that we're going to be trained. The bill is quite elaborative on who we would like to be trained on collection of the samples. In the chapter 36.8 actually goes to an extent of talking about not only police officials, but you'll also have members of IP, you'll also have members within the corrections who would be able to engage or perform those duties. So outside the policing themselves, there are also other people in the other departments that we have compiled that they will be also trained in taking their samples. Just by the way, to just elaborate a little bit on why the training must be done by the Department of Health as well, it's because it's duly legislated as such in the National Health Act, that it is the mandate of the Department of Health or the medical practitioners who shall conduct such training or provide such training to our own, who will then do the collection of samples. But in terms of the categories within the SAPS itself, we will begin with the investigators, the detectives. We have also outlined to say what type of detective from the commander's level right through to the cases, and then we'll proceed to the next functional police from the VSPOL environment to also provide the training as such. Preferably, the crime scene managers will be the last to be trained, because at some point in time they will also be able to collect the samples. But it will be the sample from the crime scene in which they have investigated. So it may be that they are in a particular province, there is a need for a police official to collect the sample, they may be able to collect the sample, but they are not amongst the top in the priorities. Priorities is detectives, then VSPOL, and then other members of the other departments on an equivalent scale to can be able to perform the collection of the samples. So the memorandum of understanding, we've already compiled the specifications of training. We've outlined the different groups during the consultation process with the different departments. We have agreed on how to approach the training from their environments as well. It's only that finalization of the processes that General Pahlani was talking about that needs to be completed so that we are able to talk to it. Perhaps in the next meeting, we may be at a later end of the discussion to see how far we have gone in terms of getting that memorandum of understanding signed by the Department of Health to be able to assist us in rolling through that particular program. Thanks.
Here, I'll ask General Jacobs to just respond to Honourable Member Kola Barnard's question about familiar searches.
Thank you, Chair. I think it very much relates also to evidence that's available in the particular case. If it points to a certain direction, if there's not enough evidence to arrest a person, and it's just a part of the broader investigation, of course it is possible to obtain a warrant for that specific person. If it's not the person that you will arrest, and that will, the act will actually allow you to automatically take the sample. So there is a possibility that in such cases that you can actually approach the court and obtain a warrant to do a DNA search. But in respect of suspects in general, once you can link the person and the person can be arrested, of course you will be able to do it. But I think in cases like the sample that she's given, that you're sort of speculating and you have to exclude some possibilities, then you will have to use the mechanisms available in the Criminal Procedure Act. Thank you.
Chair, can I just ask General Shazi to add, because it's quite a technical area.
Thank you, Chair. Just a little bit of a background of what familiar searches are to the House, and then you can just go on to highlight. I think one of the questions that the Chair asked is in terms of the ethical codes in the use of the DNA information. Familiar searches are searches conducted to try to source the originator of a sample. It means an analyst will look into the database, into what the profile exists, and try to find what are the likely people that could be associated with a particular profile. It may be that it may point out to a particular family to say this is a common occurrence within this particular group. That family will then be approached to say provide a sample. It could just be an element of criminality in there. It is a fact that has raised a number of human rights concerns all over the world on similar searches. It is quite an acceptable practice in the UK, not so in Canada and in a number of other countries, because of the privacy issues. It raises concerns of families whose private lives are at stake because someone from the DNA aspect may come and voluntarily inquire for a sample because perhaps your brother is a criminal. Maybe you didn't even know that. It raises those suspicions. But the question is, have we made provision for such in the bill? The bill is not talking to familiar searches for the reason, as it was discussed, why it has been going up and forth. It is not contained, given the dynamics of the country in terms of the constitution. The chairperson correctly alluded to the human rights issues as contained in Section 21 of the Constitution of the Republic. So there are questions that have been raised during the engagement that perhaps we may have an explicit paragraph that talks to familiar searches to say the bill shall not talk to familiar searches, which we didn't do. It may be that during the consultation process that we come outright to say what is the familiar searches in this instance, but the provision is not made in the contents of the current bill on familiar searches.
The question of the appointment date.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. 2,250 of these people have already been appointed. As we started this process in the 2010-2011 financial year, it is the 710 that we will be appointing during this financial year, and our target date always remains the end of the financial year because we do this in phases, and the appointment process is a little bit lengthier. So to ensure full compliance, we will safely target the end of the financial year. And maybe, Chair, just a question that the Honourable...
I can
we have order members, we don't just start speaking. If you want to raise an issue, you raise your hand. Please, continue.
Thanks, Honourable Chair.
Ministers also misbehaving.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the issue that Honourable George raised on what the Secretariat said, there is no contradiction. It is the same plan that we are talking to. This process started much earlier because we cannot wait until the Act is in place and then start the process. So all other processes are aligned to this plan that we'll be presenting before the Honourable Committee. Thanks, Chair.
I guess we covered for the time being on this issue. Can I just indicate to members, next week we will then deal with the proclamations, the UN proclamations on terrorism. My apologies. We will deal with that. I've closed the topic. We deal with that. We will deal with a clause-by-clause evaluation from the researchers as well as the implementation plan. Those will then be what we deal with. The week thereafter, the public hearings will start. Now, I'm raising it here so because I'm inundated with people not understanding the processes of Parliament, and one thing is just to skip certain parts of the processes. There's legislation that makes it clear that the bill needs to be advertised for a period of time. We're now in that advertising period. We will then receive the public comments. If I remember correctly, my apologies, if you're lucky, I won't be able to speak on Thursday. If I'm correct, the closing date is next. Is the 31st of this month for the public comments. The public comments then need to be evaluated, summarised, etc. We will then invite people for the participation process, the public participation process. We've put aside 3 days for that. For the time being, if we need more, we will add more. We will then try and meet, and I'm asking the Secretary of the Committee to meet with her counterpart in justice. The first part of the bill has implications on the Criminal Justice Act. And for the first part of the bill, we would like to meet jointly with the Justice Committee so that we can go through that processes together. Thereafter, Justice Committee will withdraw and we will continue with the rest of the bill. That is the agreement that we have already reached with the Justice Committee. So I'm asking that the researcher, the committee secretary, meet with their counterparts and make sure that the date suits them as well. If there is a problem with the dates, we will then continue with our part of the bill and come back to that part when they are available so that we can deal with it jointly. Ideally, we would like to start because it makes logical sense to start with that part of it. Members, I'm also going to ask that the committee section make sure that members get copies of the bills, the normal processes, copies of the bill, the public comments, etc., etc., that files for members be compiled at this stage already, please. We can then move over to the next item on the agenda. And that is the introduction of the policy guidelines. Members will remember that the Act requires concurrence with Parliament on these guidelines. And I would like to hand over immediately to the is the Minister or Secretary is going to introduce? Secretary introducing on behalf of the Minister. Minister will then leave us at this stage. Can we take a 5-minute break just so that we can get them to leave and then we can continue?
Can you use approval? How can you use approval? I can get the presentation. No, I was just going to go speak to
Yes, can we be back 22:11, please?
Okay. Sure, you want to meet me? I'm back at the office, or are you going to stay here for a meeting? Okay, sure. Okay, not a problem.
Thank you. I heard from Desiree.
Yeah.
The third person might want to address one or two of them. So I thought about to leave, but I just want to get a sense of what it is.
Yeah, you know.
speak to the Dr. Jacob.
Members, we are moving on to the DPCI legislation. Members will remember that the Act requires us to concur with the policy guidelines. This is the policy that was previously a policy that determines what type of investigations the DPCI will be investigating. This was previously determined by the ministerial committee. It is now the obligation of the minister to determine that policy guidelines and for Parliament to concur with those policy guidelines. Now, concurrence doesn't mean that we determine the guidelines. Concurrence means that we apply our minds to the policy guidelines. And policy is is exclusively the right of the executive to determine. But the committee, as a committee, and according to the Act, have a responsibility to look at these policy guidelines and to concur to that. So we will also have an official report going to Parliament to indicate our concurrence to that. I've asked Mr. Venara from Parliament's legal section to be here as well, so if it's necessary to explain further to members the difference between approval and concurrence, that he can do so. But I think let's first take the policy guidelines, and then if necessary we can refer to Mr. Venara thereafter. Ms. Kulabana?
Yeah, it's just a matter of process. I'm a bit concerned because the issue went to court. And I believe there are a number of legal challenges now coming up. Are we not premature in working out guidelines on something that may in fact be overturned, changed, other demands made by the courts in the next few months. I find this just a bit early, I think.
Because I do not believe we are. This is sub-legislation, and the legislation is enacted. Whether with or without challenges, there needs to be guidelines put in place for the DPCI to continue their work. I mean, they're not stopping their work while there are challenges in court. So I'm asking that we go through the policy guidelines, that members think clearly about those guidelines, ask the necessary questions, and then we will take the discussion further. Over to the Secretary.
Thanks, Chair. By way of introduction, General Dramat, the head of the DPCI, will go through the actual policies and the content of the policy guidelines, and General Jacobs from Legal Services is here, as well as with Bilkis Omar from the Policy and Research Unit. Just quickly, in terms of the introduction, just to inform the Portfolio Committee that we have an implementation team that has been established, which involves the DPCI, ourselves, and different sections of SAPS, including the finance section, the organizational development section that is helping the DPCI with the organizational structure, the detective services that are dealing with this, and these guidelines were then drawn up in consultation particularly with the detective services and the DPCI head. There is going to be, and there is in the implementation plan, a very clear communication plan following the approval of these guidelines, so that members of the South African Police Service as well as members of the DPCI are able to understand very clearly what the policy guidelines speak to. There also is a process that is linked to these policy guidelines to draw up a protocol between the detective services and the DPCI in terms of the practicalities around the implementation of that process, and General Dramat will talk a bit more to that. So I'll just hand over to General Dramat to take you through.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll be presenting on the policy guidelines. Why the policy guidelines? The policy guidelines, as approved by Parliament, will determine the parameters of the mandate of the Directorate. Section 17K and 1 and 2 of the SAPS Act provides that the Minister, with concurrence of Parliament, shall determine policy guidelines for the selection of national priority offences by the National Head of the Directorate, or policy guidelines for the referral to the Directorate by the National Commissioner, or any offence or category of offences for investigation by the Directorate. Just on the consultation process pertaining to the guidelines, the National Management Forum of SAPS requested the re-evaluation of the organized crime and commercial crime mandates on the 16th of November 2011. The SAPS Amendment Act No. 10 of 2012 came into operation on 14th September 2012. The draft policy guidelines aligned with the Amendment Act were drafted and submitted to the National Head of the DPCI. The draft policy guidelines were distributed to management of the Directorate, the Provincial Commissioners, and the Divisional Commissioner of Detective Service for comment. Two workshops were conducted between the Detective Service and the Directorate to discuss and finalize the alignment of their respective responsibilities, mandates, as well as to design a protocol for the referral of cases between the two entities. From Section 17B of the SAPS Act, the focus of the Directorate is to prevent, combat, and investigate national priority offences, in particular serious organised crime, serious commercial crime, and serious corruption. Section 17D1 of the SAPS Act, functions of the Directorate are to prevent and combat and investigate A, national priority offences, which in the opinion of the National Head of the Directorate need to be addressed by the Directorate, subject to any policy guidelines issued by the Minister in concurrence with Parliament. B, selected offences not limited to offences referred to in Chapter 2
and Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004. C. Any other offence or category of offences referred to it from time to time by the National Commissioner, subject to any policy guidelines issued by the Minister and approved by Parliament. National priority offences is defined as organised crime, crime that requires national prevention or investigation thereof, or crime that requires specialised skills in the prevention or investigation thereof, as referred to in Section 61 of the SAPS Act. Concerning the national priority offences, these crimes include crimes committed by persons in a position of trust and making use of specialised or exclusive, have exclusive knowledge, crimes in respect of the revenue or expenditure of the national government, or crimes in respect of the national economy or the integrity of currencies. Crimes of which the proportions require national investigation or prevention in the national interest. Crimes committed across national and international borders. Crimes where international requests for assistance are made in the investigation or the prevention thereof. The national priority offences also include the list of offences mentioned in the schedule to the Act, which inter alia relate to the security of the Republic and the international obligations of the Republic in the respect of terrorism, war crimes, genocide and crimes against humanity, non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, non-proliferation of firearms, combating of mercenary activities, and control of conventional arms. In essence, the policy guidelines provides for offences selected by the national head of the directorate, offences that must be addressed by the directorate, offences that may be addressed by the directorate, offences referred to the directorate by the national commissioner. The conclusion of protocols for the identification of possible offences that may be selected by the national head of the directorate. Protocols in respect of national priority offences not selected by the national head, and transitional arrangements. Selection of offences by the national head. Directorate must focus on crimes of a considerable extent and scope. In other words, serious or high-level crimes. The selection to be informed by a crime threat assessment. The national head must conclude operational protocols with provincial commissioners and divisional commissioners to identify matters to be addressed by the directorate. Selected offence must be a national priority offence as defined and must be aligned with the minister and the South African Police Service strategic operational priorities. Selected offence must comply with one or more of the following criteria. The offence is committed or planned in more than one province or outside the borders of the Republic by the same perpetrators. Offence has an impact on the revenue or expenditure of the national government. The offence has an impact on the national economy or the integrity of currencies. Offence in respect of which the investigation in the Republic by the service is requested by an international police agency or the police of a foreign country. Offence that involves mutual legal assistance and or extradition proceedings. Or an offence in respect of which the prevention or investigation requires the application of specialised skills which are only available in the directorate or can be sourced by the directorate. Offences that must be addressed by the directorate, this is exclusively the responsibility of the directorate, is high treason, sedition, any offence referred to in paragraph A of the definition of specified offence in the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorist and Related Activities Act 2004, any offence referred to in Schedule 1 to the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act 2002. Any offence referred to in the Non-Proliferation of Weapons of Mass Destruction Act of 1993. Any offence referred to in the Regulation of the Foreign Military Assistance Act 1998, or the Prohibition of Mercenary Activities and the Regulation of Certain Activities in the Country of Armed Conflict Act 2006. Offences that may be addressed by the Directorate. The Directorate will not address all national priority offences as defined, only those which, in the opinion of the national head, need to be addressed by the Directorate. These offences not selected, including offences which a provincial commissioner requests the national head to prevent or investigate, may be addressed by the Directorate based on certain criteria. The criteria for offences that may be addressed by the Directorate: the monetary value, the complexity of the case, the extent of the case, the public interest, the urgency, and whether it's in an organized fashion. Referral of offences by the National Commissioner must be aligned with the strategic priorities of the Department of the Police, must be in writing and, where possible, supported by documentary evidence of such offence. The aim must be to ensure that serious organised crime, serious commercial crime and serious corruption are being attended to by the Directorate. National priority offences not selected by the National Head. Protocols between the National Head and the relevant provincial commissioner, as well as the divisional commissioners, must be concluded to ensure that all offences receive attention. Offences which a provincial commissioner requests the National Head of the Directorate to present or investigate, but to which the National Head does not accede to. Any offence referred to in Chapter 2, 3 and 4 of the Prevention of Organised Crime Act, 1998. Any offence referred to in Section 13F of the Drugs and Drug Trafficking Act of 1992. Any offence relating to the dealing in or smuggling of ammunition, firearms, explosives, or armament and the unlawful possession of such firearms, explosives, or armament. Any offence contemplated in Chapter 2 and Section 34 of the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004. Any offence where the punishment may be imprisonment for life. In respect of the offences reported to the Directorate under the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 2004, the protocol for the referral of cases between the Detective Service and the Directorate. The above protocol was adopted to provide a mechanism in terms of which potential national priority offences which are investigated by or reported to the Detective Service can be referred to the Directorate, and B, a mechanism in terms of which national priority offences not complying with the selection criteria of the Directorate can be referred to the Detective Service for investigation. Then, Honourable Chair, we have transitional arrangements. The ongoing criminal investigations of the Directorate must be finalised by the Directorate until such time that sufficient capacity has been created within the Detective Service to deal with offences which falls outside the scope of these guidelines. An implementation plan for the guidelines will be provided to the Minister of Police within 1 month of approval of the guidelines by Parliament. Thank you.
I'm taking questions. Mulabatsi, Ndlovu.
Thank you, Chairperson. What is the crime threat assessment? Thanks.
Ndlovu.
Chairperson, let's go to page 19, National Priority Offence not selected by the National Head. Can you elaborate on that? Because I just want to understand what are you saying on that one. Page 19. That's page 19. And secondly, Chairperson, is the protocol.
is the protocol that should be signed between the DPCI and the provincial commissioners and so on. Has that been done? Is there any understanding of what is required from them according to these guidelines? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Legete and Honourable George.
Thanks so much, Chair. I'm on page 22. You're talking about transitional arrangement, ongoing criminal investigation of the directorate must be finalized by the directorate until such time that sufficient capacity. How do you measure sufficient capacity? And when is this going to happen? Chair, page 4, you're talking about serious. To me, corruption is corruption. Because it starts somewhere and it increases. Now, how do you measure corruption? There is corruption, there is serious corruption, there is very serious corruption. I don't know how you use your terminology. Can you explain this to me? Thanks.
Honorable George?
Sorry, Madam Chair, just one clarity. In 18, you talk about referrals of offences by the National Commissioner. Then, of course, in the following page, you talk about those not selected by the national head. My question, just one, is what happens when the national commissioner has not referred some commercial crime or crime? Say, you must remember I'm talking generally. I don't want this to be linked to any individual. I say the national commissioner himself or some that head is, or any of the colleagues are involved, and therefore the national commissioner is not referring the matter to you. What happens?
Honorable Sibiya.
Thanks, Chairperson. I would like to have the clarity. What will happen when a specific offense falls outside the operation priorities of the Department of Police?
Yes. Just one question from my side as well. It's also on page 22. Can you give us an idea of the extent of cases that you believe you are currently investigating that should not fall under your auspices? Are you going to respond to these questions, please?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. What is a crime threat assessment? It's an appreciation of the crime threat, indicating what is the extent of that threat, as well as who the key players are in that threat. Like there would be an appreciation of the crime threat of the country that would indicate that the threat that is impacting on the country would be perhaps those of narcotics, of illicit cigarette smuggling, of cash in transit robberies, and it would give an indication as to what is the extent of these threats, where do they occur, and who the individuals involved are. So that would be a crime threat assessment. The page 19, I must just share, I didn't quite get the question, but it's slide 19. Could I have another question of 19? Sorry, Chair, I just want to say. Page 20. Nothing. Yeah. Okay. I'll maybe just get back to that one. But on the issue of the protocol, has it been done? That what we have done, Honorable Chair, is that we have, with the detective service, developed an ad hoc committee specifically to look at the issue of protocols, and we have a set of protocols, proposed protocols. Obviously, these protocols are subject to the approval of the guidelines. So we do have a set of protocols, although it is, one can consider it as a working document because it's subject to the approval of the guidelines, then we can finally adopt those protocols. But we have a set of protocols which is aligned with the current policy guidelines. Yeah. In terms of Honorable Lachetlu's question on the transitional arrangements, Madam Chair, just to explain that the DPCI currently do have cases that it does falls outside. If we do apply these guidelines and criteria, would be matters that falls outside of the DPC of the directorate's mandate or could be investigated by the detective services. So the transitional arrangements is just to ensure that we conclude, and it becomes difficult for when you've started a case investigation, a case to now midstream be transferring that particular case to somebody else to continue with. Inevitably, I think the success of that case will be harmed. So that is why our proposal would be that the DPCI concludes with the cases that is currently with them. And also the reality is that at the moment of those cases, remember that the DPCI is supposed to deal with the what I can call the top slice of the organized crime and the commercial crime and corruption. And if we take the that is not top slice of organized crime, you would still require some level of expertise to order for you to investigate that successfully. And those expertise currently does not lie within the detective services. So we have to engage in a process where we build the capacity whilst we begin to divert of the or direct of the cases that doesn't fall within the DPCI to the detective services. And the as the police and with the Secretary of Police, as indicated in the introduction, that there is an implementation team that has been set up, which comprises all of, and one of the issues that the task team is dealing with is the issue of the capacitation and the resourcing, human resourcing, as a result of the implementation of the Act or the guidelines. So that is a process. However, we must say that it's very much waiting on the approval of these guidelines. So we've had some discussions, but obviously we can't implement prior to the guidelines being approved. The Act does require and does make a distinction for the DPCI to be dealing with the serious part of it, including corruption, and serious corruption is not defined, but we have, by putting these different criteria in the policy guidance, began to try and distinguish between those that one would think would be falling under the DPCI, the directorate needs to investigate, and which are those that we could refer to the detective services, and it runs throughout the organized crime, the commercial crime, as well as the corruption. The DPCI, the directorate, under the Act, won't be charged with investigating all corruption, but the serious, and we are proposing the criteria in the document for us to assist us in terms of distinguishing which are the serious and which are the ones that could be investigated by the detective services. Page 18, I'm just not sure if my... What happens when the National Commissioner does not refer? In terms of the Act, the head may still could decide to investigate. It's not dependent on the National Commissioner for its work, and referral, the head can also direct that particular investigation needs to be done by the directorate. So it's not dependent on the national referral from the National Commissioner. What happens if the case or the operation is outside that of SAPS? I'm not quite sure if I responded to the question properly. But if there would be an investigation, an incident, yeah, there is, and I'm just really trying to think if there's something, some criminal activity that is happening outside of SAPS that SAPS wouldn't be investigating. I can't think. The closest perhaps that I could is perhaps when the bodies such as the SIU perhaps investigates of the matters, and those are covered by proclamations, and we would depend currently the practice in terms of how we cooperate, allowing them opportunity, not duplicating necessary those investigations, and that is how we handle it. You would even find with the public protector at times would be receiving certain investigations, and there would be an interaction and engagement to make a determination for us not to be able to duplicate resources, or where something clearly falls within the scope of the police or the DPCI, then that would be referred immediately. There is engagement with other departments that carry certain investigations. So, and to ensure that there's not duplication of resources. Yeah. I'm not sure if I responded to the question properly. In terms of the extent of the cases, we have had an initial look and test. Our colleagues from the organizational development have specifically looked on the criteria that we have. I don't have the exact figure for you at the moment, but it is something that we're looking at. We now are engaging, or supposed to be engaging, in an exercise once again where we want to, in our protocols, we refer to a major case referral committee, a committee which is chaired by the DPCI heads in the provinces. And consists of the provincial heads, detective service, and of the different unit commanders in the provinces, to begin to look at the cases that is currently with the DPCI and begin to apply the proposed criteria so that we could get a sense of what exactly are the cases that falls within the scope of the DPCI as put in the guidelines, and for us to be able to make determinations of what our possible personnel strengths should be. Yeah.
Commissioner Jacobs wants to add something, and the Secretary wants to add something in that order, please.
Thank you, Chair. If I can just maybe refer to the fact that the committee, with the last amendment, also amended Section 16, which gave powers to the national head in relation to the provincial commissioners. And I think if one look at this interaction between the DPCI and the rest of the police service, the three main role players are the provincial commissioners, the national commissioner, and the national head. And I think that is what General Ramat referred to, that where the protocol makes provision is to have that interaction from the provincial level between the national directorate or the DPCI and provincial commissioners to get to those specific crimes that are mentioned in Section 16. Thank you, Chair.
I just wanted to clarify that page 19 that was asked by Honourable Member Ntlobo. I think what we're trying to avoid there is a situation where a case is not handled by the DPCI, but then it falls into a hole and nobody handles that case. So there need to be protocols that where the DPCI say, this case is not something we'll investigate, SAPS needs to have, there needs to be a protocol where we make sure that those cases are then properly investigated by SAPS, and that's included in the protocol. Then just in terms of some of the types of cases which the chairperson spoke about, I think at the moment a huge proportion of the commercial cases, no matter how organized they are, have fallen into the DPCI's mandate, just as an example. And some of those, and what it's meant is that a lot of the capacity for commercial crime is vested with the DPCI. Now, some of those cases going forward may not be handled, some of them will be handled, but some of them may not be handled by the DPCI, but then the capacity within SAPS to handle some of the less high-profile, less priority, less organized aspects of commercial crime needs to exist. Thanks, Chair.
Another round of questions, Honourable George Lovell.
It was a follow-up to your question, Madam Chair. Who is investigating the rating of the Public Protector's Office? Is it you?
Global?
No, Jefferson. In page 19, I'm specifically looking at paragraph 2. I want you to explain to me that paragraph. What does it mean, really? What does it mean? Offences which a provincial commissioner requests the national commissioner of the directorate to prevent or investigate, but to which the national does not accede to. What does it mean, really? In a practical sense. In a practical sense, what does it mean?
I also have a couple of questions still that I want to add. I think it's related to, I mean, I know what the answer is, but it's related to the Honourable Lawless question. The fact of the matter is the national head can refuse. That's what we're saying. Also in terms of the national commissioner requesting certain investigations. So if you can just, I think that is what the Honourable Ndlovu is adhering, is trying to show as well. In the end, if I remember correctly, the final decision rests with the national head and not with anybody else on determining that. But in that regard, will you also have protocols in place with the national commissioner for those cases that you basically deny investigating or decline investigating? Will there be protocols in place there? And if so, how far are we with those protocols, and by when can we expect them to be finalized? And then a last question, the capacity of the DPCI. Can you indicate to us, Commissioner Dramat, as the head, the national head of the DPCI, your capacity currently with these new guidelines to be able to deal with the challenges that you might have and the cases that might come to you. Just before I forget as well, the Honourable Mulabati's question reminded me when she asked about the assessment, threat assessment. I want to remind members that last day of the budget hearings that we've had when we dealt with crime intelligence, they spoke about 4 quarterly threat analysis. And those would be the analysis that would also inform these threat analysis as well, if I remember correctly. But Honourable Kula Barnett.
I'm just interested in the situation. I know crime intelligence handles threat analysis, but what happens when they come up with a report saying, yes, for example, I've got a situation, counsellor is a threat, needs bodyguards, but the relevant council refuses to give them bodyguards. Who do they then go to? Do we come here? I don't know who to go to. I presume this would be the next step up or suggestions.
I think the Honourable Fuller Bonner's question is a bit misplaced. It won't be with the Hawks, but I will ask Commissioner Jacobs in any case to respond to it. What would be done thereafter? Can I make this Honourable George?
Chair, the question I wanted to ask, I'm not sure whether it's, you see, if you look at the Hawks, or what they call the Director of Priority Crimes, the truth of the matter is that it comes at a time when I'm not saying it's right, but there's a comparison between what was their predecessors, that is the Scorpions. And now, why I'm saying this, I was listening when I was coming to Parliament, SAFM talk, where some people still say they're talking about crime, bring back the Scorpions. Now my question to you, are you doing anything to make sure that you've got the profile and publicity that because nobody talks, even when I was listening, nobody talks about Hawks or the directorate. I'm trying to say, have you got a plan to make sure that you, without doing what the Scorpions are doing, but to make sure that people know that they are Hawks and you build the confidence of the majority of South Africans who are threatened daily by crime?
I think the Honourable Member raises a valid question. It's something that I've been criticising the DPCI, but the police in general, over a number of years as well, is your inability to communicate your successes. And part of the problem, I think, that the Honourable Member is highlighting is that the Scorpions had a very specific identity. It had a specific identity. I remember with the launch of the Scorpions, as members of Parliament of this committee, we were invited to the launch of the Scorpions. And we received the caps that they were wearing, those kinds of things. There was an identity around it. And I do believe that something is not relevant to what we're discussing, but it's something that the DPCI or the Hawks need to take in consideration. Part of success of fighting crime is getting the community to understand that you do have successes. If you're not communicating those successes, you're going to be criticized, most probably unnecessarily. But who do we blame then if you're not communicating your successes?
That is why I want to piggyback to your question of the capacity, Madam Chair. Because if we talk about provincial capacity, what are we talking about? How many do you have resources that will be able to show faces when we talk about this thing? I'm trying to build on the capacity position, what the chairperson asked, and what Mr. George is asking. Because without that, that means, therefore, what we are doing here, it can be any protocol, can be anything, but if you don't have capacity, then it won't take off. What will be the capacity? Or is the capacity available at this moment as we speak?
I think, and to make matters worse, we all know the situation around your previous spokesperson. And you've now didn't have a spokesperson for how long? What's happening in that regard? I mean, it's about communicating. So you can respond to the questions that was asked. I'm seeing members are starting to pack. We're not done yet. We still have a report to adopt. So please just bear with us. The meeting is scheduled until 1. Continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the issue of the matter relating to the public protector, I'm not aware that this within DPCI, I don't have an inquiry or investigation relating to the public protector. Then the clarity around the offence, which on that slide 19, and for an example,
Perhaps if one could use an example that the provincial commissioner of KwaZulu-Natal, if I can use that as an example, might in assessment experience a spate of armed robberies in a certain cluster.
Honourable George, I'm going to put you and Mr. Legeto, Honourable Legeto, in the corner of this room. Continue, please.
And then the Act would then allow for the Provincial Commissioner to submit the specific incident and request investigation of the specific incidents to the head, to the DPCI for investigation. And the head would then look at the guidelines and to see that whether indeed the specific request of the provincial commissioner, the head, the DPCI, should and could investigate. Excuse me, for the specific request that the provincial commissioner made, then the, one of the outcomes of that could be that the head sees that it falls outside of the scope of the DPCI and of the guidelines, and therefore would then refer that back to the provincial commissioner, detective services, for investigations. What we have done in practice now in the interim is to take an approach of where the DPCI in certain instances becomes almost like a consultant. We don't actually take the case docket, we hear what the issues are, and we dispatch one of our members to go and assist and to guide. That is the approach that we've been taking now in the interim, so that it does we offer some guidance to the detectives at the station on a particular investigation that could be challenging to them. Madam Chair, your question was about protocols, and when you were talking, I wasn't specifically, but what you were saying is that in the protocols do cater for, or is included for the, that was your question was for the...
My question was whether you are also establishing a protocol with the National Commissioner.
With the National Commissioner. The protocols is it's included in the already. It covers all these areas of... what happens when the DPCI refers and accepts? What happens when the DPCI gets and doesn't accede to it? What is the process and the communication that happens? The protocols covers all of those, Madam Chair. Just your comments on the crime threat assessments. It would be one of the sources of the crime is the Crime Intelligence Division, but there's also other government agencies, the State Security. There's NICOC, and we do interact. We specifically have a priority crime management center who does our information management, and they do engage with those stakeholders in terms of obtaining threat assessments and having further analysis of a particular threat that would guide us in terms of our investigation and prevention strategies. The capacity of the DPCI. Currently, we do have investigative capacity throughout the country in all 9 provinces. In certain provinces, we have relocated in. We have a geographical spread within the provinces. Like example, the KwaZulu-Natal, we'd have offices in Pietermaritzburg. We've got offices in Port Shepstone, as well as in Durban Centre itself. The focus of those capacities has been a lot on the organized crime as well as the commercial crime, because those historically are capacities that's been in the police and it's been strong. The anti-corruption investigation capacity, there we are lacking, and our numbers are not as much, was not able at this point in time to match the amount of incidents that we have, but we're working on that. Then in terms of our priority crime management centers, that is also completely new, So it's also in its infancy stage of development, as well as the section that we brought in of the financial and asset forfeiture investigation section. It's a section to particularly support the operational investigation, particularly looking at the issue of following the money and making sure that we don't just go for the conviction, but we're able to also deprive criminals of the ill-gotten gains as well. That is new, and it's also small in its at this stage, but is capacity. We are currently investigating a sizable portion of the organized crime and commercial crime investigations. The number of dockets, I think the organized crime would be some in the region of 23,000, 24,000 plus. And in the commercial space, it's about 14,000 is the amount of the caseload now at this point in time. But the issue of what we don't have, and it relates to the question posed around the whole communications, that at the moment we don't have communications. We're not structured as such. It's one of those services that we've been reliant on or dependent on the mother body, if I can call it that. But it is within the proposed plans for there to be a communication capacity that specifically will be able to deal more effectively with the issues of our corporate identity. We do have, to a limited extent, but also the issue of being able to communicate these successes. And Madam Chair, there are quite a number of significant successes that the DPCI do reach. And one is the agreement that it does not always get told, and it does not always. We do need to do a lot of work in terms of communicating these successes on a range of crimes, from your narcotics to our cash intransits, even to the corruption. There are a number of significant successes that we are achieving, and I think we do have a challenge in terms of our ability to communicate those successes. Having said that, Madam Chair, one do ever get a sense that on the ground, and this is based on a request that my office gets in terms of people referring matters which falls outside of the DPCI scope, but it does show to me that there is some confidence on the ground from communities in terms of the DPCI and its ability. In fact, it's creating a bit of a problem, because one will sooner or later get swamped. And it's not all matters that would fall within the scope of the DPCI. Just to balance things out a bit, that I have observed that there is a level of confidence that there is amongst ordinary members of the community. But I would couldn't agree more the need for us to profile and to put the DPC, the orcs, out there, and to further enhance the confidence that people would have in the DPCI. The one on the CI threat assessments, I think General Jacobs will respond to that from Honorable Colonel Barnett. I did say that we do have a capacity as is, and obviously we begin to look at the impact of this mandate purification, and obviously if there is a movement of caseload, there is a possibility that there will be movement of personnel to follow, and I think, Madam Chair, that collectively I don't think there's sufficient capacity to deal with the organized crime and commercial crime and corruption phenomena as we speak, even within the DPCI. So there will be, I think, in the short term, a migration of forces, but it won't be satisfying the full capacity requirements. And it's something that is going to have to be built over a period, Madam Chair. Thanks.
Commissioner Jacobs.
Chair, if you could just help me, I'm not sure whether I heard the question correctly.
The Honourable Member was relating an issue that she knows about a councillor that's life has been threatened. Evaluation was done, but the VIP protection unit, stroke crime intelligence, refusing to give protection. What is her next step?
Sorry, if I may just correct that. Crime intelligence absolutely did their job. They wrote the report, presented it to the relevant council authority, and they are refusing. They are questioning the veracity of the crime intelligence report. Councillors are doing that.
Chair, I think what you have correctly said, that there's a different section dealing with this, protection and security services, so the crime intelligence report will go there. But I don't know whether General Dramat can add to that.
I think the problem that the member has is that normally, insofar as councillors are concerned, if there is a threat, the council themselves would then provide security. The council is refusing to do so because they're not. They're saying that crime intelligence report is not. Can I ask, instead of us trying to solve it here, that you speak to the honourable member after the meeting? Because actually, it's okay. Can we do that, please? Anything else that we want to add? The commissioner was saying that they have capacity and they are in all 9 provinces, but that they do need capacity in certain areas and that there will be a migration from SAPS members towards the AUKUS. They will strengthen the numbers of the AUKUS in the short term as well. You want to add?
Yeah, Madam Chair, sorry, man, if I maybe go to under incorrect. The movement, I think, in the short to medium is more likely from the current DPCI to the SAPS, not the other way around, because the entire expertise and skills to deal with organized crime and commercial crime is now currently within the DPCI. Yeah, that is the current situation. So when we apply this guidelines and the criteria, there will be a movement, and we're going to have to, in the immediate short term, migrate personnel to the detective service in order to deal with the matters that is not selected by the head.
Now, that's why now I think the general now is creating a problem for me, because by saying that, are you saying that therefore that the capacity of DPCI, the AUKUS, will be okay? That's what you are saying, because you can't migrate people from your side to the people who are many as we speak, to the department that has got a bigger number than to the section that has got a bigger number than yourselves. But in the meantime, we have a specific job that we have to do. I'm using that, Madam Chair, through you, because of what my colleague said, because of the capacity and the publicity and the way how the work should be done. I'm looking at that. I'm not questioning the way we are doing it, but I'm questioning the migration process within. It doesn't take out what you need to empower other sections.
I think that's also why I also asked the question. We need to know that within the redefined criteria, do you have the capacity to deal with the crimes that you believe is going to come across your table? That's a simple part of it. Now, the fact that SAPS does not have people in detective services capable of dealing with organized crime is a problem on its own. And you know that, again, you speaking about migration of your officers now to them just illustrates again about the crisis management in SAPS. Why are SAPS not training people within the detective environment to be able to deal with this?
I mean, it's not as if they didn't know they needed it. But let the head of the Hawks answer the question around his capacity. I don't think somebody can answer on his behalf. Then you can come in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, as we speak, there is capacity to deal with the mandate as defined. There is capacity, and there are certain shortcomings as well in terms of our approach. As I indicated, there's the issue of the new financial and asset forfeiture sections. There's the priority crime management sections. There's the anti-corruption investigation component, which is underdeveloped. Right? But there is capacity at the moment, as we speak, to be able to deal with the mandate as defined. Madam Chair, there is going to be, if we're looking and we take the whole thing of combating and investigating these phenomena, the whole of it, if we take the holistic approach to it, we're going to have to send some skills that is currently with the DPCI. We're going to have to capacitate the detective colleagues in the immediate term. But also gives an opportunity for the DPCI to be able to grow and to get skilled people, the required skills, because not all the skills required is currently there within the DPCI. There's areas, for instance, like our cybercrime investigations, which is really also at really its infancy stage. So, and we do have some people that is there, and maybe it's not the people with the right skills at this point in time. So it also allows for us to move so that we're able to attract sufficiently skilled people as well.
I was just going to say, I think General Dumont covered me in the last, but part of it is also to make sure, because, for example, all commercial crime people landed up in the DPCI. Some of them are not even suited for the DPCI. So there might be a migration, but there's also going to need to be a development of capacity within the DPCI. And some of it may be bringing people in from SAP, some of it may be bringing people in from other government departments, some of it may be training existing people. But I think that is exactly the process that General Dumont was talking about, that the implementation team is looking at within OSD. But there may be people, some of the migration that will happen into SAPs are people that don't necessarily fit within what we would like to see in terms of DPCI going forward.
Members, can we close the subjects? Can I say that I think we might need to have a meeting, even if it's not in this quarter, with the implementation team at some point? Because the things that you are raising also have financial implications, obviously. And one needs to know what those financial implications are. Again, not because we want to criticize it, but in order for Parliament to support you in those financial implications. So at some point we will schedule then a meeting for the implementation team and yourself to come and just to give us a briefing in terms of where you are, medium term, short term, and long term, what needs to be done in order to capacitate fully. Members, I'm putting the following report to you. Report of the Portfolio Committee on Police on the policy guidelines determined by the Minister, submitted for concurrence of Parliament under Section 17K4 of the South African Police Service Amendment Act 20 of 2012, Act No. 10 of 2012, dated 28 May 2013. The Portfolio Committee on Police, having considered the subject of the policy guidelines determined by the Minister, submitted for concurrence of Parliament under Section 17K4 of the South African Police Service Amendment Act 2012, Act No. 10 of 2012, for selection of national priority offences by the National Head of the Directorate and referral of any offences or category of offences to the Directorate by the National Commissioner, concurs with the provisions made in the regulations referred to in this section. Can I get a mover? Honourable George?
I thought when you introduced, you promised us that these learned people behind us will come with the
difference between concurrence and...
Members, are there a need for that? Do you want that? We can do so. Mr. Venora, can I ask you just to briefly explain to members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The difference between approval and concurrence. Concurrence would basically be where there's a meeting of the mind. In this particular instance, it will be where the committee has now received these guidelines from the minister, who is empowered in terms of Section 206 of the Constitution to develop these guidelines. In other words, the power to develop these guidelines resides with the minister. It is in the committee's oversight function that that is provided in terms of the SAPS Act as amended that gives the committee the competency to concurrence, meaning that there's a meeting of the mind between the committee and the minister. If the committee was not happy with one or two issues, then it would make proposals for the minister to consider. If the minister agrees with those, then there's a meeting of the mind, then there's concurrence. Approval is a bit of an authoritative term, because you find that concept mainly in delegated legislation in the form of regulations, because the power in terms of the Constitution to legislate resides with Parliament, and therefore when Parliament gives ministers the competency to legislate, that is a delegated function, and therefore in that delegation, when you delegate responsibly, you say you go do X and Y and Z, but you come back to get approval. That is not the case at hand. The case at hand is the issue of concurrence, which is what the committee has just done. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Venora. Can I then, I'm not going to read the report again. Can I get a mover for the report, please? Mr. George, can I get a mover for the report, please? Honorable Ndlovu is moving. A seconder? A second by the Honorable Sabia. Thank you very much, members. Members, before we adjourn the meeting, can I ask the ANC members to stay behind, please? The next week's meeting then will be around the UN declarations. We will take a clause-by-clause evaluation from the researchers. And that's it. Yeah, and that would be the agenda for next week's meeting. we will also... Now, the researchers are going to give us a clause-by-clause evaluation on the book. Evaluation, not the presentation on it, the evaluation. We will ask the department also to be present so that when we do have questions of clarity. I'm talking now on the DNA bill. If we need clarity, that you can provide us with clarity on certain issues. That is where we are at this stage. Members, we have our debate on Thursday. Now, I believe, Secretary, that the function has changed again. Function has changed again to dinner. It was dinner, then it was lunch, and now it's dinner again, but we haven't received any official notification thereof. So I would urge that you address that so that we can make sure that members get the invitation for the budget debate. It's dinner now again. So it will be immediately after our debate? Half past seven. Yeah, because there's another debate taking place in between. Members, can we have order, please? You will get your invitations there too. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.
She didn't pay away. Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask the ANC members just to stay behind, please?
the implementation plan as well of the DNA bill next week. Yeah, please.